My name's Jeremy Moss. I'm the director of the Social Justice Initiative here at the University of Melbourne. And before I start, I'd just like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people who are the traditional custodians of this land, and I'd also like to pay my respect to the elders, both past and present, of the Kulin Nation. I'm very pleased to be able to introduce the Social Justice Annual Lecture today, to be given by our guest, Pat Anderson. Because for the Social Justice Initiative, which is generously supported by the university and the faculties of arts, law, medicine and economics, our brief is to engage with important social justice issues that are prominent in Australia and beyond. And we thought it was timely to have our annual lecture this year on one of the most important social justice issues facing Australia today, which is, of course, the intervention. Rightly or wrongly, what's become known as the intervention, which began 2 years ago last Sunday, has come to encapsulate part of the government and society's response to some of the disadvantages faced by Indigenous people. And we thought of no better way of engaging with this issue, 2 years after the intervention began, than to ask Pat Anderson to come and give this lecture. Pat Anderson has spoken before, as many of you will know, before the United Nations Working Group on Indigenous People, and was formerly the Chief Executive Officer of the Danila Dilba, the Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Service in Darwin. She's been the Chair of the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, which is the peak national Aboriginal health organisation, and is currently Chairperson of the Cooperative Research Centre for Aboriginal Health. And those of you who have followed her work know that she's been a strong advocate of disadvantaged people and about Indigenous people and health. For our purposes tonight, Pat has a very special qualification in being one of the co-authors of the Little Children Are Sacred report and is uniquely placed to discuss the intervention. Pat's going to speak for around 40 minutes, and then there'll be time for some brief questions after that. So I'd like you to all join me in welcoming Pat Anderson. Pat.
Good evening, everybody. I too would like to follow and pay my respects to the traditional owners of Melbourne and all their ancestors here tonight. So I'd like to acknowledge and pay my respects accordingly. But I'd also like to pay my respects and acknowledge all of you who are here today. And many of you I know and many I don't, but for the work that you do within your families and your communities, and I pay my respects to all the work that all of you have done up to now. This week marks the second anniversary of the National Emergency Response to Protect Aboriginal Children in the Northern Territory, announced by the former federal government on 21 June 2007. As you know, the emergency response soon became known simply as the intervention. It was announced supposedly in response to an inquiry that I co-chaired with Rex Wild QC into the neglect and abuse of Aboriginal children in the Northern Territory. Although I should say at the outset tonight that the intervention did not address any, not one, the recommendations from our inquiry. Tonight, 2 years on, I'd like to share with you some of my own reflections on both the inquiry and the intervention. Along the way, I want to puncture some of the myths and assumptions that seem to float in the background of the public and policy debate, subtly but powerfully influencing the story that gets told about Aboriginal child neglect and abuse, the intervention and the relationship between black and white in this country. Let me start first by taking you back to 2006. In May of that year, following a number of stories in the media about sexual abuse and violence on Aboriginal communities, the ABC TV Late Line program screened an interview with Alice Springs Crown Prosecutor Nanette Rogers, in which she described in horrific detail some of the cases of abuse that had come before the courts. While the details were both shocking and real, in a general sense, much of what she had to say was not new. It was, in fact, well known. The issue of Indigenous family violence, and especially of the abuse and neglect of children, had been raised for many years at the highest levels by concerned Aboriginal people, communities and organisations, and also non-Aboriginal people. For example, the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody in its landmark report almost 20 years ago stated, and I quote, "The history of disruption, intervention and institutionalisation to which Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families and children have been subject has left many of those families confronting severe difficulties in securing the adequate care and control of their children. It is apparent that many Aboriginal families are in crisis." In 1997, the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission's Bringing Them Home report went further, highlighting the alarming numbers of notifications and substantiations of child abuse and neglect in our communities. And in 2001, the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Council, a very conservative body, formed to give advice at the highest level to Australian government, made the protection of children from abuse and violence, including sexual abuse, the second of 9 priority areas for action by governments, both state and federal. So it is a myth that governments did not know about Aboriginal child neglect or abuse until the storm of media and public concern broke in 2006. Our communities and organisations had been alerting government to the facts and calling for action for years. But it seemed that our calls for action fell on deaf ears. But when the mainstream media take up an issue, that apparently is a different matter. The Late Line program started a media frenzy, especially when the following month it aired another program alleging the existence of a pedophile ring in a Central Australian community. Suddenly, it seemed that every newspaper and every television news report contained a shocking story about the abuse or neglect of Aboriginal children. The issue became front page news. And now governments were under the kind of pressure they understand and to which they react. Of course, the serious health and social issues faced by Aboriginal communities need to be brought out into the open, need to be debated, and where there is abuse and violence, this should be exposed and the perpetrators need to be brought to justice. That is without question. And the media can play an important role in this process. But the media's quest for drama and conflict can also be destructive. I believe that much of the reporting at this time and after, even if well-meaning, ended up reinforcing damaged mythologies about us, our lives and our communities. Aboriginal families felt that they were all being accused of mistreating or neglecting their children. Aboriginal men in particular found this a difficult and distressing time. All too often, the media merely picked up the old stereotype of the violent black man, amplified it and played it back to the public at full volume. Now, we all know good men, men who care for their communities, families and children, who felt shamed walking down the street, who felt that people were looking at them thinking, there goes one of those pedophiles. This tended to put some people and communities on the defensive and make the real issue, the welfare of children, much more difficult and not easier to address. That's been lost. I'll return to this point later. Much of the public attention was focused on the Northern Territory, despite most other jurisdictions also had produced reports on sexual violence and sexual attacks on children. But when Mel Brough, the Federal Indigenous Affairs Minister, weighed into the public debate, the pressure on the Northern Territory government to address the issues became intense. So in August 2006, the then Chief Minister of the Northern Territory, Claire Martin, announced the formation of the Northern Territory Board of Inquiry into the protection of Aboriginal children from sexual abuse. There was a lot of cynicism at the time when she announced this. People said that it was a whitewash, that nobody would talk to anybody from the inquiry, and that it was just a sort of desperate attempt by the government at the time. I was asked to co-chair the inquiry along with former Federal Police Commissioner Mick Palmer. Unfortunately, Mick had to withdraw soon after the announcement, and Rex Wild QC, a former NT Director for Public Prosecutions, was named in his place. I want to take a few minutes to describe the inquiry and how he went about producing its report, Little Children Are Sacred. The terms of reference of the inquiry broadly asked us, one, to look at what contributed to the sexual abuse of Aboriginal children. Two, to identify barriers to the provision of effective responses to and protection against that abuse. Three, to look at how government and non-government agencies might contribute to a more effective protection and response network. And four, to look at how the NT government could help support communities to prevent and tackle child sexual abuse. So how are we going to go about getting the answers to these questions? The answer was, of course, by talking to Aboriginal people and organisations and by talking to service providers and government agencies. Over the course of almost a year, we travelled to over 40 Aboriginal communities around the Territory and held extensive community meetings to get Aboriginal people's views on how to ensure that their children grow up safe, healthy and ready to be part of their community and indeed the nation. I think we held over 200 meetings, and we decided we would go have a sort of spread of communities, some small, some large, some were troubled, were called hotspots really at the time, and communities that were perceived to be doing okay. So we took a spread, both the north and the south. We also took the time to establish a relationship with the communities we were to visit, particularly because, as I mentioned before, the media and public debate had left many feeling cautious and defensive, to say the least. We had staff go out in the first place, we wrote. We had staff go out, talk to the decision makers and the leaders of the community, wherever they might be situated, and often they're not in the council office. So we sat down with everybody and they invited us. We made sure that they knew about the terms of reference. Rex and I also made a DVD, because people often don't have really good reading skills, so we were able to send a DVD so people could see us and hear us, and we could explain by talking to people about the terms of reference and why we were coming, so to cut down a lot of that confusion. So we had meetings. We at every community we had at least three meetings, one sort of a meeting with everybody, then we split up into men and women, and then after those meetings we then had meetings with all the agencies who provide services in that community, whether, you know, the police, the school, the clinic, the sport and rec person and so on, depending what services were available in that community. So we spoke to that group separately as well. Then at the end of all of those meetings and talking to people, we went back again and held a series of regional meetings and put up on a big board like this, this is what you told us. Do you want to change anything, or are you sure about this? So everybody knew what everybody else had said and everybody confirmed those sort of main issues. So we had meetings in Darwin, in Nhulunbuy, Catherine and Alice Springs, and the Tennant Creek people came down to Alice Springs. We invited those people that had actually attended those community meetings so they could come again. We asked each community to send two people, a man and a woman, to those regional meetings so we could sit down and workshop what we had found. In going around and talking to those 45 communities, there, of course, as I said, there were some trouble spots, and there were lots of places where a few people turned out to talk to us. But even in those places with a good turnout, not everyone, of course, wanted to speak to us. I remember one, I know this community really well, it's a troubled community, and we set up, we'd made all the arrangements as I've described, and one young woman turned up to the meeting, and she was running a local family violence program. And that did happen in places, but in other places, there were, you know, heaps of people came out. In other places, and I'm thinking particularly of that Central Australian community that had been the subject of massive TV and media reporting, we were met very politely and with some suspicion, as a lot of people there obviously still felt pretty pissed off by being targeted, as they saw it, by the media and the politicians. But overall, you know, I was really heartened by the response we received. I just wonder if we put a notice up on the shop in one of the suburbs in any Australian town or city and said, come to a meeting tomorrow afternoon or Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. These people are going to come and they're going to talk to you about sexual abuse of your children. So that was a big feature that people were able did come out and want to talk about this very sensitive subject. In some places, the public meetings were attended by up to 100 people, and this in places that might only have a total population of a few hundred men, women and children. It is particularly positive and significant that where people did turn up, I have to say a high proportion of men participated. In one community, there was a large community just outside of Darwin. Only about 10, 12 women turned up, whereas there were 80 men at the men's meeting. And then we had another group of younger men as well with a similar number. That was really unexpected at that particular community. For all that, what struck me most in these talks with the Aboriginal communities was their attitude. They had suffered much as a result of the historical processes in this country, and many of them had suffered violence and abuse themselves. Many were sad, distressed, and shamed by what was happening in their communities and in their families. But they were owning the problem. They were not turning away and saying it was too hard. They wanted to work with the professionals. They wanted to work with the government and with the service delivery organisations. They wanted, in other words, to be part of the solution. Throughout, there was a sense of great concern about children and young people and the threats they face. People were worried about kids not going to school, about girls having babies too young, about drugs and alcohol, the lack of jobs, and the presence of pornography. And while we did not uncover individual cases of child abuse, we found all the conditions present under which it happens: poverty, overcrowding, drugs and alcohol, pornography, and perhaps most disturbingly of all, a breakdown of structures of authority and meaning. We found too that many who came forward and spoke to us were child victims of abuse and neglect who had never had their trauma acknowledged or dealt with. Throughout our conversations with Aboriginal people, we were mostly received with openness and trust. There were daily reminders about the complexity of people's lives and situations. We felt that we had been invited into an intimate space. People trusted us and believed that we would be the initiators of some action. Indeed. Both Rex and I felt a huge burden of responsibility and were compelled, at the very least, to faithfully record these concerns, their ideas and life experiences. But alongside this open attitude, we found a huge lack of government services. For example, many communities had no police presence. Child protection workers were few, far between, and often burnt out, so overwhelmed with the most acute cases of abuse that long-term prevention work with families and communities was an impossibility. As for family therapists, child psychologists, social workers, and all the other specialists you would hope to see as part of a system for effective dealing with child protection, child abuse and neglect, they simply did not exist in remote communities, and it's not that much better in the towns either. Clearly, the warnings of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, let me remind you, from 1991, and the Bringing Them Home report and the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Council, to name a few, clearly talked about all of these issues. Clearly, these warnings about family breakdown and abuse in Aboriginal communities had been largely ignored. Perhaps this failure to act contributed to the attitude of some of the senior bureaucrats we consulted during the process of the inquiry. Because the sense of urgency about the protection of children that we found in Aboriginal communities was, I'm sorry to say, in stark contrast to some of the government agencies to whom we spoke. There were some agencies which clearly had been putting little thought and energy into how to deal with child abuse and neglect. But there were some agencies who had put some thought into it, and this is my prejudice, but the most thoughtful agency was in fact the police. In fact, on the communities, people told us they would rather deal with the police than the occasional, you know, 6-monthly visit from the child protection worker. But there were other government agencies who showed little sense of urgency, understanding or purpose when we came to talk to them about the plight facing Aboriginal children. There seemed to be a lack of an intellectual framework and little idea of what they should be doing, how they could be doing better, and what they would need to do a better job. There were no practical forward-thinking plans. These agencies seemed reactive and passive. They seemed to have become places where the problems were all just too big, and where the Northern Territory was not seen as a place where things could happen, a place that could come up with solutions. I was and still am puzzled and shocked by this attitude. Where does it come from? Maybe the inquiry that Rex Wilde and I were conducting was seen as a threat, and not by some agencies. They could have seen it rather as an opportunity, you know, for more resources and use it as leverage, but they didn't. Maybe some of those we spoke to were being good public servants, and they thought that being too open with us would lead to criticism of them, their department or the government. Maybe an ethos had developed in these agencies where we Aboriginal people were seen essentially as a problem. I got the sense that some of these agencies were blind to the positives of Aboriginal life and culture and didn't see the sheer potential of our people that was being lost. I want to emphasise that this attitude was not universal. There were and there are always public servants with energy and commitment. But this attitude of passivity and reaction was common enough to shock me, especially after meeting with Aboriginal communities where people were determined to recognise and deal with their issues. After Rex and I had finished the consultations, we sat down to write the inquiry, the report for the NT government. We called it Little Children Are Sacred because this reflected what some of those communities told us, from Arrernte people in Central Australia to the Yolngu of Arnhem Land, that children, all children, are central to their societies and pivotal to their societies, and indeed are sacred. Our main finding was consistent with what many Aboriginal people have been saying for a long time, namely that there is a significant problem in Northern Territory communities in relation to sexual abuse of children. Indeed, it would be remarkable if there were not, given the similar and significant problems that exist elsewhere in Australia and abroad. We put forward almost 100 recommendations to address some of these issues. These recommendations covered a whole range of areas: child protection services, health services, policing, rehabilitation, prevention, family support, education, housing, alcohol, employment, and more. But none of this was new. There is nothing in the Little Children Are Sacred that hasn't been said before. All of this is really well known and well documented, and everybody's been talking about this for, you know, at least 20, 25 years. Anyhow, be that as it may. But for me, the very first recommendation was the most significant. It said, it is critical that both the Northern Territory and federal governments commit to genuine consultation with Aboriginal people in designing initiatives for Aboriginal communities to address child sexual abuse and neglect. This recommendation was strongly informed by the willingness and determination of many of the Aboriginal community to work with the authorities to address the problems they faced. Of course, we recognised straight away that these recommendations would take a lot of resources to implement, and we knew that the Northern Territory budget is tiny in comparison to the resources of the Commonwealth. So although we called for the Northern Territory government to show leadership, we were explicit that this required national action and that the federal government needed to provide much of the resources for the solutions. Hence our call for Aboriginal child sexual abuse in the Northern Territory to be designated as an issue of urgent national significance, by both the Australian and Northern Territory governments. We delivered the Little Children of Sacred Report to the Northern Territory Government in April 2007, by ourselves, I might add, in a back room at Parliament House. There wasn't a single politician there, just Rex and I and a whole room of reporters. Now, maybe Rex and I were naive. We sincerely thought that given the level of public concern and the fact that they had commissioned the inquiry, the Northern Territory Government would want to act urgently to address the issues we found. We thought that they would ask themselves, what can we do within our current resources, and how many more resources do we need? And we expected, and were ready to be part of, an urgent and formal approach to Canberra to get a federal commitment to a joint effort to address the issues raised in our reports. But nothing seemed to happen. The inertia and lack of interest that we had noted during our consultations with some government agencies seemed to have struck again. I asked myself once again, as an outsider to those government processes, why did the government find it so hard to act? So why did the Northern Territory Government commission a report which they must have known would identify areas of long-term neglect where money and large amounts of money would need to be spent? Was our inquiry merely a way to deal with the media and political pressure that built up during 2006? Were we just supposed to be part of the government's effort to manage the issue? These are cynical thoughts, perhaps, and to counterbalance them, I remind myself that I know that there are also people in the NT government who are pushing for real action on the basis of the report. But before that internal struggle between action and inaction could be resolved, before the inertia could be overcome, the federal government beat them to the punch. On 21 June 2007, the then Prime Minister and his Federal Minister for Indigenous Affairs announced the emergency intervention into the Northern Territory. This announcement was firmly predicated on the Northern Territory Government's lack of response to Little Children of Sacred. But in actual fact, there was almost no relationship between what we recommended and what the Northern Territory intervention encompassed. And this is becoming even more blurred as we go along. Our key recommendation about working with Aboriginal communities was ignored. Where we emphasised the need for resources and the flexible processes of engagement with Aboriginal families and communities, the intervention emphasised external control and blanket provisions affecting all Aboriginal people. There were many elements of the intervention announced that day. Not all of these were wide off the mark. There were moves to restrict alcohol availability, enforce school attendance for children, increase policing, and ban pornography. However, no one needed an inquiry to tell them about these measures were needed. There had been broad agreement for a long time about exactly these kinds of actions and numerous recommendations from studies and reports to act on all these issues. Aboriginal kids were not going to school. They haven't been at school now for a generation. There are two generations of Aboriginal kids who cannot read and write. There are in fact cohorts of kids in remote communities who have developed a communication, a form of language which only that 30 can understand. They can't communicate with their own, even their own families. They can't communicate with anybody outside that cohort of 30 or 40 kids. And no one seems to think this is an issue. But the majority of the headline elements of the intervention were deeply problematic. They included compulsory health checks of Aboriginal children to check for evidence of abuse, blanket quarantining of welfare payments to all Aboriginal people, leading to the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act, plus the compulsory acquisition of Aboriginal townships, and the scrapping of the permit system that allowed Aboriginal people at least some control over access to their land. All this was accompanied by a get tough, quick fix rhetoric that clearly implied where the problem lay. It was with us. It was Aboriginal people who were to blame. Never mind the years of reports to government identifying the problems and suggesting solutions. Never mind the consistent neglect and under-resourcing of services to Aboriginal communities. Never mind the inaction and complacency. No, in the end, it was clear that we were to blame and that John Howard and Mel Brough were now going to give us a good shake, sit us down and get it all sorted out, get us all sorted out once and for all, since we were obviously incapable of doing it ourselves. The paternalism inherent in the intervention seemed to escape most media commentators, but it did not escape Aboriginal people. The difficulty was, the intervention presented a real dilemma for Aboriginal people at the local community level as well as the national level. For some, this was a long overdue recognition of the continuing disadvantage of Aboriginal communities and the need to act decisively to end it. On the other hand, there were those who opposed the intervention for its attack on rights that had been hard won by the Indigenous peoples of Australia over many years. And there were many on the continuum between these two positions. People who were trying to get more information about what was being proposed and how it would work, or those who opposed some of the elements of the intervention were unsure of some, but saw potential in others. However, driven by the media's appetite for conflict and drama, and by the government's own black and white rhetoric, the debate quickly became polarised. We were divided, whether we liked it or not, into those who supported the intervention versus those against, between those who adopted a rights-based approach or those who are focused on the need to protect women and children, as if these were opposing principles. In my view, it is a real problem when public debate about such an important issue becomes polarised in this way. Yet this was inevitable, given the way the intervention was presented to the Australian people. The question remains, what did the former government want to achieve? I don't think we'll ever fully understand the process by which federal governments decided on the intervention. The key decisions were taken behind closed doors, and little effort went into uncovering exactly how they were made and who made them. Accordingly, there were lots of speculation about why the intervention was announced. For some, the intervention was a cynical political exercise to wedge the Labor Party and gain narrow political advantage in an election year. As is well documented, the former Prime Minister was practiced at finding exactly those issues, such as immigration, which resonated with a large proportion of the Australian public while dividing his political opponents. According to this view, the intervention was Tampa Mark II. And although we aren't likely to ever know for sure, I would certainly not discount this as part of the motivation. Second, some have seen the intervention as an ideologically driven attack on Aboriginal rights. Under this scenario, the NT government's inaction gave Howard the opportunity to advance his agenda in Indigenous affairs, central to which was the undermining of Aboriginal rights to land. There's a view that runs something like this. Clearly, the blacks were getting uppity. They were getting too much control, far too much land, and it was time to put them back in their place. The intervention as a counter-revolution to Wick and Mabo. This undermining of Aboriginal rights to land, I think, was central to the intervention and explains why so many of its elements had nothing to do with children and why almost none of the recommendations of Little Children are Sacred were included. However, some saw the intervention as a genuine attempt to address the suffering and neglect of Aboriginal children. Many of our people would have difficulty with this, and indeed, looking at our former Prime Minister, I find it hard to see him as having much compassion for Aboriginal people. Nevertheless, perhaps for others in government at the time, this was part of their motivation. But whether this was true or not, I would argue very strongly that concern by itself is not enough. I remember once seeing a small poster in an Aboriginal medical service which someone had made and put up on the wall, which simply said, "Concern plus ignorance equals paternalism." This sums up neatly to me some of the atmosphere of the intervention which so many of us found so frustrating and demeaning. The assumption that somehow all these years No one had been doing anything for the health and welfare of Aboriginal people until suddenly Mel Brough rode over the hill on his white charger. You know, there were lots of people, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal, who devoted their lives, and some of them are in this room, in fact, to working with Aboriginal people, trying to improve Aboriginal health outcomes. So they were left on the sidelines there. I don't know whether you realise this, when those clinics went into the Northern Territory, the government clinic or the local Aboriginal community control clinic was still there, but the new clinic was just come and set up somewhere else. So we had two clinics in the smallest, and of course we had the army as well. You know, very, very confusing for people. Because the soldiers didn't know what to do. They ended up kicking football with the kids, you know, but still still with guns. This ignorance of the history and realities of Aboriginal life and the disregard of the evidence of what works in such situations of disadvantage seem to me to be a key feature of the intervention and those who led it. But whatever the real motivations behind the intervention, one thing I know for sure, it was not the welfare of Aboriginal children and communities alone that drove it. All sorts of these other agendas were at play. Political positioning, ideology, electoral advantage, and good old-fashioned arse covering. And this seems to me to be a continuing theme in the history of the relationship between black and white in Australia, that action on Aboriginal disadvantage gets continually caught up in other contradictory agendas. This perhaps has been the biggest barrier to genuine progress. Because you would think that if government was really serious about addressing the disadvantage so many Aboriginal communities suffer, there would have been a rational process, some process, you know, to sit down and look at what the problems were, to look at what has already been tried and what we know works, to look at the kind of principles that we know should underpin action, and then a commitment to action and of resources. We know a lot. We know a lot about Aboriginal people. We know a lot about Aboriginal health. We know a lot about education, employment. I mean, what we don't know, you could put on the end of, you know, end of a pin, pretty much. So we know a lot. We can't pretend that we don't, and the government has access to this whole body of knowledge, yet they continue to act outside of it, as if we're dumb, or as if Australia is sort of anti-intellect or something. I'm getting really impatient with this point of view. Yet as far as we know, the whole intervention was almost literally designed on the back of an envelope over 2 or 3 days in some offices in Canberra by people who took little account of the evidence and had no understanding of the historical realities of Aboriginal life. Now, some people have said to me, but something had to be done. Of course I agree, something had to be done. But if you were seriously ill in hospital and something has to be done, you expect that the something that the hospital staff do to be both aimed at treating the illness and to be based on good evidence. You know, you trust the doctor that he's doing something, he knows what he's doing, that he has a whole body of knowledge and a whole career there. Doing something that is neither well-intentioned nor well-evidenced is unlikely to be helpful. And the intervention was neither well-intentioned nor well-evidenced. I've argued strongly that urgent action was needed, but that it needed to be based on both on the evidence of what we know and works and on our rights. You know, because what we're talking about here is actually, you know, is the protection of children. I don't have time tonight to go into detail about these, but I do want to say that I think that the artificial distinction that the previous government set up between rights-based and practical approaches is false. An approach to addressing Aboriginal disadvantage that is based on respect for our established rights is necessary because in the long term, it is the only one that, practically speaking, will work. You cannot address endemic social problems without the collaboration of the people affected. You certainly cannot pretend that the nation state can intervene in a sensitive and difficult area, such as the relationship between families and children, without the community fundamentally accepting this approach and endorsing it. My experience tells me that our people are more than ready to support an intervention to create better, safer futures for their children. They told us so. But if this is at the expense of their rights, rights that historically have been hard won, people, even those in the most, with the most goodwill, won't cooperate. I know there are some communities where Aboriginal people, and especially Aboriginal women, support some of the aspects of the intervention that others see as violating their rights. There are a number of places, for example, where Aboriginal women have spoken out in support of the compulsory quarantining of Centrelink payments, which, although it necessitated the suspension of the Racial Discrimination Act, they say has led to improvements in their communities. Now, if those communities want to collectively make the decision to restrict welfare payments in their community or for particular families, we need to respect those wishes and learn from their experience. Such a model is being trialled in Cape York. The Family Responsibility Commission there is enforcing standards of behaviour and helping people resume responsibility for the well-being of their community and of the individuals and families who live there, especially children. This is a community-based commission from community people who are discussing about their families and then indeed their neighbours, and they come to a negotiated settlement of how they're going to proceed. They do this in a way that aims to encourage and support local authority and justice, not undermine it with blanket, externally imposed solutions. And I ask myself too, what is being put in place to assist those communities and families to resume full control of their welfare payments? Or is the welfare quarantining payments permanent now? Is this how it's going to be? Is this how all Aboriginal families are now going to have to live? Because with the intervention in the Northern Territory, there are many places where the welfare quarantine measures in particular have caused much resentment and led people disconnecting from services and processes to address disadvantage. They've stirred up memories not that deeply buried, of times when the nation state believed it had a role in the personal lives of all Aboriginal people and exercised control over them in a way that it never attempted to do so for non-Aboriginal citizens. This is part of my family history, a history shared by many, many Aboriginal families, when it was taken for granted that Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal families should be treated differently, and that the state, with its institutions, had a right to be present, as it were, around the kitchen table. Acknowledging this history and working with the complexities and diversity of Aboriginal life across the territory and across Australia, accepting that what will work in one place may not necessarily work elsewhere, or at least not without adapting it to the local community, its priorities and capacities. This is one of the key policy challenges that Australian government must take up. I've been speaking so far of the intervention as it was announced and implemented in those first few months after its announcement in mid-2007. But much has changed since then. In November of that year, a new federal government was elected. We have a commitment to closing the gap. An apology was delivered. The intervention was reviewed, but has largely remained in place. Because, you know, there have been some changes. But this change has been driven by an enormous amount of work at the local level in the Northern Territory to transform the intervention into something positive. Aboriginal communities, medical services, and those in government with goodwill and energy have been working, sometimes literally day and night, for 2 years now, not to waste the opportunity of national attention, to hold governments to their rhetoric. They have persuaded government that compulsory health checks were an unworkable violation of rights, and they were dropped. And there were many people, lots of doctors around the country came in, including the AMA, so the government quickly backed off that at the time. They have used the evidence, those organisations and groups in the Northern Territory, they have used the evidence to show that the kind of fly-in, fly-out medical teams that the intervention gave such prominence to might be good TV, but they are not good health policy. Now, long-term sustainable funding for health services is being rolled out. At the moment it is, anyhow. Some of the more problematic attacks on Aboriginal rights to land have also been rolled back. All this is due to the commitment and knowledge and work of those at the grassroots level. I want to leave you with some words from Barack Obama, whose election at the end of last year had given hope to so many. In his book, Dreams from My Father, he says, "I know, have seen the desperation and disorder of powerless, how it twists the lives of children on the streets of Jakarta or Nairobi or Chicago's South Side, how narrow the path is for them between humiliation and untrammeled fury, how easily they slip into violence and despair. I know that the response of the powerful to this disorder, alternating as it does between a dull complacency and when the disorder spills out of its prescribed confines, a steady, unthinking application of force, and it's inadequate to this task." This describes so well the very process we have experienced in Australia when it comes to the welfare of Aboriginal children. But there is another process at work too. This is the power of the community to argue, to persuade, to use the evidence of their own experience and to transform the world, their world at least. It is my firm belief that those who so generously spoke to us during the consultations for the Little Children Are Sacred did not deserve a response that was so heavy-handed and so lacking in basic human respect. This still weighs upon me, as I know it does upon Rex, the co-author of the report. We feel that what people told us, what they trusted us with, and what we reported, which was then used by those in power to pursue entirely different aims, in fact, to punish. Over the last 2 years, the intervention has been very divisive for the Aboriginal community nationally. But the process has opened up an opportunity for change. The Aboriginal community and their organisations and those who support them are using this opportunity to achieve something permanent and positive. They are continuing for their long struggle to improve the lives of Aboriginal families despite the continuing odds. And in the end, despite everything, I'm hopeful that they will succeed and that Aboriginal children will live safer, happier, and more fulfilled lives. But for all this talk, for all the debate, for all the argy-bargy, for all the dialogue, the whole thing, the whole issue, the whole everything is really about keeping Aboriginal children safe so they may grow up and reach their full potential. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pat. Now we've got time for some questions, if people would like to ask some questions. So if you just raise your hand, I'll call you as I see you. Yeah.
Thanks, Pat. John Matthews. Could you enlarge a little on the role you think that educational reform could help to solve
It's key, John, as you know. We had another report in the Northern Territory called Learning Lessons, which is now 10 years old now. It was commissioned again by the government. Come up with recommendations saying what the government should do about getting kids to school, and nothing's done about that. The schools are largely, you have to go to school. Black kids have to be able to function in this world as well as their own. They have to be competent and capable and confident in their own culture as well as in this. They have to know how to operate between the two. This should not be an issue. This should not be debated. This is how it is, although there are some Aboriginal who don't necessarily agree with that. And that's okay. If they were at home, totally submerged in their own culture and were doing all the ceremonies and doing everything they're supposed to do, but that's not happening. That's broken down. So a lot of these young people in particular, some young people, that are in their mid-30s can't read and write. We have, like I said, two generations that can't go to school. So they have no stake in this. They don't give a darn what you think or do, because they have no stake in this. They're outside of it, and they're meant to feel outsiders. So They have to learn to read and write. They have to go to school. Imagine if you're 4 or 5 and you go to school. Your mother does care about you and sends you to school, despite what everybody else says. She gets you dressed, she feeds you, she sends you to school. Now you get in the classroom and this is your first time at school. The teacher, she can't speak your language. Or she, he might be a he. And nor can you speak hers. So how is that teacher going to inspire this child that this is a wonderful adventure that they're embarking on, that they've got a lifetime of learning and they're going to have this one, go on this wonderful journey together? She can't, the kid can't understand a single thing she's saying, nor can she understand what he's saying. And no one thinks this is a problem. This is not new. There's been decades of this. Education is key to any kind of progress or advancement. All the leaders today, let's talk about the Northern Territory, everyone you read about in the paper every day, went to school. They didn't go to some little, you know, place under a tree. So they went to a proper school with teachers who'd come from down south, and all the best families and all the best clans are the clans of status. They send their kids here to Geelong Grammar. All their boys go to Geelong Grammar, those that are the elite clans. They know, you know, so that's how the leaders, or they go to Nudgee Boys in Brisbane. It's got a, both schools have got a very good reputation with our boys. Education is key. They can't, you know, mother, if the mother can't read, you can't translate that to your children. You can't read the labels on the food in terms of, you know, how much fat's in there, how much sugar and all this. It's just so essential. It's not unusual to see grandmothers and grandfathers filling out and reading the Centrelec forms for their grandchildren because they've had at least grade 5 or grade 6 and can read forms and things. These kids can't. In fact, that generation does not value education at all. We're talking about parents now in the Northern Territory, mums and dads. She might be 16, he might be 17. They don't know anything. They can't even read and write. Nor do they value it.
Thank you for saying that, Pat. I was up at Gagawiyak last year and I went into a prep class with a girl from Brunswick teaching, and she had 25 little Aboriginal children and they couldn't understand, and she couldn't understand their language. She had to do all her teaching through an Aboriginal aid. So I heard Fred Cheney say about 3 years ago that Aboriginals have to be educated to be two-way people, but now I've come to understand that the people that go up there to teach and to work with them in other ways, they have to be two-way people too. And that means a huge amount of money and education has to be put into those people.
Mm. Thank you for raising that, because Aboriginal families get the blame for not sending their kids to school. No one has questioned the system. Is that school, you know, what's happening in the school? Why aren't these kids going? It may be that she's lazy and won't get up, but it might be that the school isn't treating them properly and they're not, and the kids, look, black kids are like, they're really smart. You know, they just vote with their feet. Well, I'm not going back there tomorrow. And they don't. I'd rather go swimming and fishing myself. What? How is she going to engage me? So it's a, look, there's been so much done on this education. The Northern Territory will not do anything about it. It's not rocket science. I went to lots of schools where they're all fenced now, you know, 6-8 foot high fences, and the rubbish is about 2 metres high up the fence, all rolling around the school like tumbleweed. There's a young teacher wandering across the yard in many cases with dreadlocks and, you know, big baggy clothes on and no kids. And the kids that are there, they just put on a DVD, you know, just do a bit of child minding. Because she's already got an attitude, well, they're not going to be here tomorrow. I might have a different lot tomorrow, so why should I bother? There's volumes written on this about what needs to happen. This is not new. I used to work in Aboriginal education 30 years ago. I'm saying the things that I did said 35 years ago. No one takes a blind bit of notice. Paul.
Pat, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the response to the intervention from the non-Aboriginal sector of Australian society. This is not the first of these abominations and it probably won't be the last. You told us about division in in Aboriginal society, but you also mentioned that the AMA, a conservative medical organisation, actually opposed at least some aspects of the intervention.
Just the one about the, what do you call them, the compulsory checks. They're very invasive. Look, I don't know. I think there were some Australians who really thought, genuinely enough, that the Prime Minister was doing the right thing. You know, that they, those blackfellas really needed to be finally dealt with. But it's hard for me. You guys know. I don't know. I don't know, Paul, how the rest of Australia felt. Nobody did anything. Nobody said anything. The army rolled in there, you know, including us, you know, us as well. We didn't do anything. Let the tanks and the trucks roll into these really small communities, and all the soldiers with guns and everything, trying to put up little tent clinics and what have you. I don't know. How do you guys feel about it?
Sorry, there's one up there.
Dan, you mentioned building relationships with a lot of the communities that you went to as part of preparing your report and the positive responses you got to people actually attending. Mm. As a result of the intervention, how do you feel that, as that was by the government and through the media portrayed as being a response to that report, how do you feel that's affected your relationship with some of that?
Oh, I think a lot of people do blame me, and me more than Rex. Because they know me, and I'm sure there are many communities and many individuals who do blame me, that it's my fault that all of that happened. There is no doubt about that, and I feel a great burden by that, because, you know, people were very, very generous with their information and expected something to be done, but nobody thought what happened would ever happen in this country, but it did. So, yes, my reputation is severely damaged.
Is that difficult because they were such different sources, really, and different processes that were went through, that were then went through to get to that same? It's really like they were very detached, from what you presented. So it's been hard.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't understand the second bit.
I meant the what you're saying, the government's response was really detached from
the
process that you went through.
Oh, absolutely.
By a different group, really.
Yeah.
No,
the NT. In fact, I've not had a single politician speak to me about anything. I had, Jenny Macklin had a brief meeting with her, but not one Northern Territory politician has ever had a single conversation with me or Rex about any aspect of it. They really don't want to know. It was like they asked us to. I was happy to do it, because I had been speaking out a lot. I thought, oh, this is a real opportunity to sort of get something down. But Rex and I were always suspicious of the government's motive. There's no doubt if we weren't, you know, that naive. So we did sort of have some other plans for if they didn't do anything about it, but we were all kind of beaten to the punch by the Prime Minister, previous Prime Minister.
Quite a few times that the evidence has been with us for more than 20 or 30 years, but it seems the problem's in the response. I'd like to ask a question, though, as to how much of this issue is really an Indigenous issue and how much of it is more related to entrenched long-term social disadvantage. Over the last 10 years, I've been involved with some national research mapping disadvantage by postcode. We see very similar levels of child neglect and abuse, of domestic violence and substance misuse and criminal behaviour in the most disadvantaged communities around Australia that aren't Indigenous.
Mm.
But the responses of government are often short-term, single-dimensional, non-engagement with those communities. It seems that it's a more generic problem. Of course, there are some Indigenous dimensions to it, but how much is it one of entrenched long-term disadvantage?
All of the above, I think. Everything with us, you know, you have to sort of multiply it again. There is long-term disadvantage. But what is so frustrating is that all of this lack of infrastructure has been known for some time, but nothing has ever done about it. This is the abuse of children now is like it's at the end of the continuum in terms of breakdown. You know, when a society turns on its children, it's in severe crisis. When it turns so in on itself that its children become its target for abuse, it's in a serious condition. But we've been going down this track now for a long time. Now, white Australia thinks those black fellas, they get a lot of money. Where does it all go? They're still sick, they're still dirty, they're still drunken, they're still lazy, they're still uneducated. Where does all the money go? Well, in fact, it doesn't get down often to where it's most needed. And government departments make terrible decisions. It's if there's a change of government, that's one of the big problems. It's a change of government, everything has to change. So there's no continuum. That's why I think maybe we need a Bill of Rights here. We need some kind of covenant. We need some kind of national document. I mean, heaven help us, like they even have in America. So the Native Americans at least have some kind of established place, position. So if and when there are changes, it's not so dramatic. Whereas for us, we've got to go over it all every time there's a new government. So we've got some serious fundamental flaws, I think, in our system. But Aboriginal disadvantage now has been going a real it's a long time, and there's this level of abuse in our community. I suggest it's just as bad, if not worse, in the non-Aboriginal community. Except heaven help us, we are talking about it. Well, the Aboriginal community is talking about it. And we're just a split. There's no kind of, Aboriginal people have a whole range of views like you guys do as well. No different, really. And I didn't answer that question very well, but I'm happy to talk to you about it. Jane.
Can you see any opportunity? You said there's been one thing that's come out as being an opportunity for change. But can you see any good, or can you talk to us about good that's actually come out of this?
Well, I can tell you that a lot of the Aboriginal organisations in the Northern Territory are taking the money and trying to run. I think that's good. Why not? while it's there, I think that's a perfectly good thing to do. The government is saying that this level of funding is going to stay, especially with the AMSs and other services and agencies, and I think that's a good thing. But there's still no long-term strategies and plans. Like, everyone talks about COAG, this sort of where they all get together and make plans. They have the big plan, but there's no plan for how that's actually going to be implemented. In fact, I've been talking to a few people that maybe a few of us need to go to Nicola Roxon and say, Nicola, you need a plan here. Set up a group that's for 6 or 8 months and get them to work out the detail on how it's actually going to happen. Everyone talks like some kind of mantra, about closing the gap. But who's doing what? Everyone's sort of running over each other. Who's doing what? Is there a conductor here? Is there someone driving this bus called closing the gap? I think the answer is no. It's just all these sort of different, and waste. Money so wasted. So much money wasted when it's so needed. We need an army of early childhood teachers. They need to get better pay. They need to be better trained. We want these kids to start going to preschool when they're 3 so they can get used to a structured day so we can start to engage them. And then the literature from here and abroad this is where to start. You have to start. By the time they're 7, it's all over, Red Rover. We have to start with the babies and even the cuddling, how important that is, but there's a lot of talk about that end, but nothing is actually really done. Certainly, one of the recommendations Rex and I called for because of the Learning Lessons report was that the next school year, February, that every 3-year-old Aboriginal child in the Northern Territory attend an early childhood development centre. Now, we knew that would never happen, but we just wanted to make the point. That's still on the books, but that's what needs to happen. But early childhood teachers, they're so poorly paid. Who's going to go from Melbourne to Kintore or Docker River and open an early childhood centre under a tree, and it's bloody 40 degrees? But for that in itself is a really, that's a massive task, but that's the sorts of things that have to change, that's basic infrastructure.
We're running out of time, so I might just take one quick question. Was there one over there? No? Yeah.
I was interested that you talked about coordinating, obviously, an approach to closing the gap and a lot of the issues, and there has been the Health Task Force set up by Nicola Roxon in Amherst, chairing one of them, and how are they feeding into things going up in the territory, particularly in the context of Jenny Macklin and what seems like some consultation and prevention. I know it's a big last question, but where are things at now in terms of?
I don't know. Short answer is I don't know. There are so many committees. You know, FACSI is falling over itself. They know nothing about anything. They're kind of falling over themselves. We've got that committee. We've got several committees. There's no conductor. There doesn't seem to be any central point or person that's got the blueprint and has costed it out and says who's going to do what. You know, Ian's committee, I don't know what they're doing. Sorry to call it Ian's committee. Ian Anderson chairs the Inequalities Committee. A longer title than that. There's lots of them too, lots of other ones.
Look, at that point, because we do have the theatre just for a limited time, before I ask you to join me in thanking Pat, I'd just like to, first of all, thank you all for coming. If you'd like to stay in touch about other social justice events, you're welcome to sign your name to a sheet there. Can I just quickly thank two people as well, Michael McGann from Social Justice, and in particular Selena Hughes, who did lots of the work to make this event happen. And just before we thank Pat, we'd just like to present this small token of our appreciation for coming to talk to us.
Thank you.
That was very, very moving and very powerful, Pat. And
thank you
very much. So can we all thank